Sunday morning, and he tells me that he has regularly driven Charlie Stevens around, and that he's been called to go pick up Charlie Stevens. And he gets there, and there's no place to park. He says, so I look at these cars, and he said, I see there's Lloyd Jowers close to the hydrant, and in front of Lloyd is a pickup truck, a little truck.
Okay.
So you see, I'm getting here confirmation that Ray's car was gone.
Not there, right, okay.
He said, I figured that I know Lloyd. I don't know who's driving the trucks. And I know that Lloyd's not going to pull out, so I can park double, leave the hydrant clear, and not cause any trouble. He said, I went up to Charlie's, and he said, Charlie was so drunk he couldn't even get out of bed. Now, what I'm telling you now is the kind of thing that can be confirmed. He said, so I went down in my car, a cab, and he said, I called my dispatcher and told him what happened, and asked him if he had another fare for me.
He did call a dispatcher?
By radio.
Okay, so there's another guy who knows that.
It was more than that.
Okay.
There's a manifest that was confiscated by the FBI and we don't have. You know, they keep a record of all these things. So the dispatcher gives him another fare. I believe he said it was at a yacht club. And he said he hadn't driven very far when the dispatcher comes on the air with an alert to stay away from this area because there's been a shooting. It was that close to the time of the killing that Charlie Stevens was so drunk he couldn't get out of bed. Now, I got other witnesses on this that nobody knows about except Jim. People who saw Charlie Stevens in the police station that night and they didn't even know what in the hell he was there for. The cops were guarding him so nobody could question him. But this is someone who was then a reporter in Memphis, now is not, and volunteered the information to me in February 1971.
Mm-hmm.
I think he said it was 9 o'clock that night. I got a memo on this, not a tape.
Right.
Now, McCraw also told me that the FBI had gone to the cab company immediately and had confiscated his manifest. Because obviously it would have proved that he had gone to pick Charlie up.
Mm-hmm.
That he had not picked Charlie up. And that immediately he had gone on another fare. And of course they had to keep Charlie alive because they can't place Ray in Memphis within 2 hours of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
The only way they can ever place Ray in Memphis is through the purchase of those binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
is Stevens still alive?
Pardon?
Is Charlie Stevens still alive?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know where he is.
Mm-hmm. Is he in Memphis?
Yeah. Ninth floor YMCA in October.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get there early in the morning.
Otherwise, he's not seeing straight after about 11.
You got to find him then. He's wandering around in the bars.
Okay.
I was there too late, and then I didn't have time to go back.
Okay, so
I went there before we started the evidentiary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Livingston and I went there the first day I was in Memphis for the evidentiary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to get back
okay,
again.
Okay, the manifest the FBI has.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you see, I've got proof. And I got Jowers on tape on this. That's exactly where his car was.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed Jowers in the James Earl Ray room of that flop house because what actually happened is that the flop house was divided into two. Jowers rented the one in which that room was and in which his bar was.
Mm-hmm.
And my interview with Jowers was actually in that room
mm-hmm.
on tape.
Okay.
It's a funny coincidence.
Yeah.
The one that Ray rented. Now, there's more on this. But
okay, you interviewed the service station guys too? That,
no, I stayed away from him.
Okay.
No, I don't want to flag anybody.
Okay.
That's an important witness. He is no longer in Memphis.
Okay.
That's one
you want to hold for trial, clearly. Okay.
The way things are now, I'm not at all sure we're going to need it. I don't think that they dare let this case go before a jury. There's not enough to go to a jury. There is nothing at all except enough to justify prosecution of all sorts of people not ready.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there is more on this, Esther. I'm just giving you the outlines of it. Let's get back now to how the crime was committed.
Right.
These people have gotten rid of Ray. Ray's duffel, some of it, enough of it, is in the flophouse room.
Mm-hmm.
They take it and they wrap it in the package. Now, they were careless. I told you they were careless.
Mm-hmm.
Then they bought a loading rifle. There was a bullet in the breech ready to be fired, and they didn't even put the clip in it. Jerry
Fenton.
Yeah,
tell me about guns. Tell me about guns.
Now, this was a rifle that repeats itself without the individual loading of each shot.
With a clip.
By a clip and a mechanism that is called a push.
Okay.
You pump it. So when you pull it back, you eject what is in the breech after firing. It's an empty shell. When you push it forward, you put another charge in. There was no clip in the rifle when it was found. Jerry Franco is crazy. Used to go crazy on radio shows when I would question him. I got a tape of this.
Mm-hmm.
It was on the Jerry Williams show, explaining why Ray would go around when he's going to commit an assassination with an unloaded rifle,
mm-hmm.
and have a clip and not use it, have an individual bullet in his pocket, and then go through all the incredible gymnastics it takes to put a bullet in when it's going to fall out the bottom if you're not careful, because there's an open hole at the bottom where the clip goes in.
Okay, so when that gun was found in...
No clip.
Package. No clip and no gun, no bullet in the breech.
One bullet in the...
Which means you would have had to have fired, ejected the old shell, and hand manually put in another bullet ready to go.
And have no means of firing a second shot or defending himself.
Because that bullet in the breech is not ready to go.
Come to think of it now, I don't remember whether that was an empty shell or a full bullet.
Okay.
It is important, but it's easy to find out. I don't want to tell you when I'm not certain.
Sure, okay.
But there was no clip.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you can do is to use the clip and put a bullet in the breech and firing position,
mm-hmm.
take the clip out, and put another bullet in and have an extra shot that way. And nobody is going to depend on having his first shot work, and nobody is going to depend on not having to defend himself and escaping.
Mm-hmm.
So, a very stupid thing that should have alerted the police right off the bat. So these people give Ray enough time to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go down to where they're going to commit the crime and where they have a different car. Now, this is part reconstruction and part eyewitness testimony.
Mm-hmm.
It is my reconstruction that the crime was committed from the parking lot and no other place.
Mm-hmm.
It is Bertie Reeves' testimony to me that the shot was fired from that parking.
Mm-hmm. Where was Reeves then?
Reeves' room was right at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Reeves' room, in which he was, gave on the parking lot. He was on the other half of the two buildings. I'll turn this off until you get that. And the next morning, the state cross-examines McDonald on it. But the fact... Oh, I was telling you about the bathtub. I went there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only one way you can get in a position to fire. And that is to stand on the rim of the bathtub with your left foot and let your right one dangle into the bathtub.
Okay. Window, tub. You're saying standing
the
up...
The tub is close, is farther away from you. The tub is up against the wall opposite where you are. Let's take this as the bathroom, Esther, this part of the arm of the chair.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And where my two fingers are is the window.
Okay.
The bathtub is up against this wall.
Oh, the
doorway is over here.
Okay, wait a second. So the window is not in that corner of the room, it's in this corner.
No, it's in the corner where the bathtub is.
Above the tub?
It is almost in the corner, but not quite. McDonald's mistake was saying it was right. Let me turn this off and save some tape.
Sure. I want to talk about the possibility of making that shot, and McDonald got caught.
Well, McDonald didn't get
no,
caught.
But I mean, he was in less sure footing, less sure ground, than he was kind
he
of...
He made a little mistake, but it didn't change the essential truth of what he testified to. It was obvious. I had it in a frame-up without ever having been there.
Right.
Besides that, remember, they limited it even farther by the allegations they made about the windowsill.
Sure.
There's only one way that the muzzle of a rifle can make a mark on a windowsill, and that's by the muzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you've got a long tubular channel mark, because
mm-hmm.
the whole bottom of the barrel. Muzzle is the end. The part out of which the bullet comes.
There's a barrel and then there's
the barrel is the part down which the bullet goes.
Travels.
The far end of it is the muzzle.
Is that an extra piece or is that a...
No, it's all one piece.
One piece, okay, right.
One end is the breech, the other end is the muzzle, and in between the whole thing is the barrel.
Okay, fine.
Now, the barrel is partly protected by wood and partly not protected by wood.
Mm-hmm.
There's only one part that could make a hole, and that's the muzzle, the business end out of which the bullet comes.
Mm-hmm. The front end of the muzzle, you're not talking about the bottom.
The front end, no, there's only one end of the muzzle, that's the front.
The muzzle, okay.
The front of the rifle is the muzzle.
Well, I've got it.
Now, that is the only part that could make a mark. The rest of it is perfectly round and flat.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have an edge to make a mark. Either that or you've got a long continuous mark from a direct right angle blow.
That would be like
a... Yeah, so the only way the mark could have been made was by the muzzle. Now, if that was done, it had to shoot through some of the windowsill on the wall to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Because the most fantastic part of all that I discovered...
And the inside of the sill, isn't it?
I discovered that when I went down there. They cut the inside out, not the out. The outside is still there. And they left a piece of the inside of the still in under the left stile, and I got that piece.
Mm-hmm.
The up and down part.
Yeah.
Now, there's only one way that rifle could have been shooting if the muzzle was resting on the inside of the windowsill, and that's upward.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody had any interest in killing the man in the moon. But nonetheless, that mark limits the outside point of the rifle, according to the official story.
If the front is here, then the rest of it has to fit someplace.
Behind it,
yeah.
Inside the building. And this is what McDonald was talking about, and basically he was right. The only thing he didn't do was allow a couple of inches on the left in the room, but his testimony is still truthful.
Mm-hmm.
The picture didn't show it clearly. So there's nothing wrong in McDonald's improvised testimony either.
Okay, so what is your feeling about that mark was just a mark that was there and they just decided to...
They didn't testify to it, remember. They just... they talked about microscopic marks.
Right.
Can you imagine microscopic marks on weather-beaten wood?
Mm-hmm.
And from a finely machined barrel? There are no microscopic marks.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, I've examined that. And it looks like somebody hit it with a ball pin hammer.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have been a ball pin hammer, but more likely a ball pin hammer. A hammer mark.
Mm-hmm.
It's at an angle. Now, this is one of the things that the state refused to give us pictures of. We had a hell of a hassle. They pulled the dirtiest kind of tricks on Jim and me by lying to the judge in open court when they interrupted proceedings because they were refusing to comply with discovery, and this is one of the things. But we have Xeroxes of it. And with the Xerox, we could be certain that McDonald was looking at the same mark. Besides that, it was marked on the original with chalk.
Mm-hmm. That cell is now...
It's in Bubba Blackwell's possession.
Is that available to be looked at or not?
It's under the same conditions as the bullet. I doubt if you can.
Now, we assume that the FBI has pictures of all of it.
I assume so.
And we've got more, we have more freedom of information rights.
I don't think you do when it's an investigatory file for law enforcement purposes. But I would be willing to try it if I were you.
We're going to give it a go. I mean, right? I think they're going to say no to everything. I think they're going to say no to everything. I've asked for the model. I've said no to that. That's the first thing I asked.
Are you doing it in writing?
Not first.
You better hire Jim.
Well, we're going to do it with our own mucky muck first, you know, our own rigmarole. We've got corporate people who will do until we get down to where we're having to sue.
Well, you're going to stall yourself unless you start doing it the right way.
Right, okay.
They can make you spin your wheels a long time without you getting any good copy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You do your thing your way.
I was going to talk. I asked Jim, I said, who's the leading expert on freedom of information besides you? He said, I guess I'm not. I said, I'm tormenting you and spending enough time as it is. Okay. But the FBI having absolutely no jurisdiction in the case right now. There's no way that they can legitimately have a jurisdiction, right?
You misunderstand the law. The law deals with the purposes for which the file was compiled.
At
the file was compiled for law enforcement purposes
of a
because they faked them. they contrived a
that
fake
conspiracy
loss.
Charge, right,
mm-hmm.
and which they've now dropped.
But you may have another handle on it,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be your consultant.
Okay.
The FBI did not have jurisdiction until after the Birmingham indictment. So if that windowsill was removed prior to the Birmingham indictment, you've got an arguable point that that part of the file was not compiled for law enforcement purposes.
Mm-hmm.
They would then argue that they did it as an adjunct to the Memphis police. And I don't know how you would argue that.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, the rifle was not under the same wraps. They listed just for a certain kind of...
I don't know why it was that way, but Bubba pressed it on me. He was a fine southern gentleman.
Yes.
The last heir of Boss Crump.
Right.
Oh, could I give you a story about Bubba and Boss Crump?
Okay, that'll be later. Right now, okay, I have to check the day of the Birmingham indictment and see what this...
I have the Birmingham indictment in the book, and you can...
Yeah, that's right. I just put a note to myself.
What actually happened, Esther, is that within 5 minutes, Jensen was on the phone and got an okay from Hoover
mm-hmm.
to involve himself in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've done some thinking about that, and it convinces me that the FBI had a man at the scene. And that he was in touch with Jensen by radio,
mm-hmm.
not by phone.
Mm-hmm.
It couldn't have happened that fast any other way.
Have you ever talked to Jensen?
No.
He's out now, too. He's retired.
Yeah.
He's at Holiday Inn or something in Memphis or Nashville.
That's what I understand.
Yeah.
As a matter of practice, I tend to stay away from these people.
Yeah.
Because they're going to lie to me.
Yeah,
they don't
right.
have to talk to me.
Right.
And I got a limit on how much time I can spend
right.
on this when I have no income and no way of paying my expenses.
Right.
So I try and have my own order of priorities
right.
and what I do with the limited time I have.
Sure.
It's not that I never speak to these people. I sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never without success because I've been careful
yeah.
in who I try to talk to.
Sure. No, we have to. I mean, it's just, they may yes, say they won't do it. I think we may get a blanket no from every one of them we want
now,
to talk to.
Now, let me give you this advice.
Mm.
Before you question Jensen,
mm-hmm.
I've got the transcript, the Otwell transcript. And, of course, you have it in the back of Clay Blair's book.
I haven't found Clay Blair's book, but I either, if I'll find it in the next couple of days, or I'll borrow a copy from Jim or something. And
yeah, you
a couple
can
Xeroxes,
see it.
Yeah.
Mine is marked up, see, by the same
sure.
Jim's.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, I would read Jensen's testimony very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you would like, I can help you. I can help prepare whoever is going to interview Jensen
mm-hmm.
for that interview.
Mm. Okay.
If he grants it. But
yeah.
you have to prepare for it on the chance he does.
Sure.
A lot of questions he was never asked. That he should have been asked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back on Jensen. You speculate, we know that the Justice Department was watching the Civil Rights Division anyway and was protecting people.
Oh, Lowey was there.
Oh, Lowey?
Lowey was on the same floor in the motel.
Okay, I don't know.
Lowey. He went from there to Harvard. I met him on a talk show in St. Louis with Jerry Frank when Jerry Frank's book came out
mm-hmm.
on an independent station out there.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten the guy's name. I have it written down.
Okay.
And I got the tape of the show. Lowey was on it. Lowey was there in King's Party. He was from Community Relations. I think he was in charge of Community Relations of the Justice Department.
Okay.
Besides that, in spite of all their lies, the FBI always had agents around King. I know him.
And we know it now from what they were trying to get him.
Aside from that, they actually have bodyguard agents. My source on this is a reputable man in publishing who used to be part of King's protection in a certain city. And although he's an intellectual, he's a physically very able man. And he told me, and I don't believe he lied, that King's people always met the FBI people, so they would know each other. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is true or not, but
yeah.
I believe this name.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that's how Jensen found out about it, because he... All right, that was in the book. You said you established that time, Stephen. He moved right in.
Pardon?
Okay, and Jensen moved right in. Hoover said, go.
That's right.
You do it.
And he took over.
You think... And so if the FBI is any good at all, we've got all reasons to believe Jensen right away, so that's not the guy who did it. I mean, that gun didn't shoot it, and everything else that goes along with it.
Esther?
Yeah.
My work on this is to the point where I can prove that the picture that I got in the suit was a stage picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that the package...
That's the package sitting there with the radio right
up.
Yeah.
That was a stage picture. The package was handled and moved. I can prove all of this.
Okay, let's go back to that package. They're going to plant it. The guy's going to plant it in the car. He sees the car isn't there. He puts it down in the doorway.
No, he takes it with him until he's ready to put it down in the doorway.
Okay, then...
Now, this is reconstruction. It could be either way.
Right, okay.
But my belief is...
But he didn't toss it there on the run.
No, he didn't toss it
right.
on the run.
Okay.
And there's no reason to believe he did.
Mm-hmm. The chancellor, put it down, continued, walked out to the parking lot beyond that, and then the two of them take off.
Now, at the point when it was dropped, the man could have been on the run.
Right.
Because he expected the shot to be fired right away, and he had to get back in the car to drive it off.
Right. Except the few people who saw somebody who said anything at all, so any man walking at all saw a man walking. No one ever saw anybody running down that street.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, there's something else you should understand.
Mm-hmm.
That it is not possible for anybody to have been invisible to Gormley.
Okay. Gormley
is partly crippled. He was then a sheriff's lieutenant.
Uh-huh.
He took one look at that wall, and I got pictures of it with Jim standing there with his hand up, and he can't even reach the top.
Yeah.
And he decided not to jump. Even if he crawled to the front street, first of all, he had an unobstructed view as soon as he turned.
Uh-huh.
So nobody could have gone past without him seeing it.
Okay.
No car could have gone without him seeing it. And second of all,
Gormley's coming out of
the back of the firehouse at the corner toward the...
He's not going to jump the wall because he's got a problem.
And there's a walkway right out to the street.
So he comes out the back.
Yeah.
I mean...
He turns to the street.
And he's responding to the gunshot already.
That's right.
And he's not going to jump. So
it was a matter of seconds before he was on the street.
Where's Gormley now? Is he still a cop?
No. Gormley is now in the public defender's office. That's where I found him. He's an honest man. Now, his estimates of time are subject to all the limitations of eyewitness testimony.
Of anybody, yeah.
But I wasn't in the room when Jim questioned him, took his testimony. But I believe Jim said it had to be less than 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
I am telling you it had to be appreciably less than half of a minute. I've been there.
Okay, but for argument's sake...
Wait a minute. Yeah. I think Jim and a friend of his timed it. And they can tell you how long it took then.
Yeah.
It had to be less than a minute, Esther. Now, there wasn't enough time to make the package and get down from upstairs.
That's what
no matter how you figure it.
Right. Gormley was never interviewed by... or his testimony, nothing was ever introduced. Does Gormley say anything about how he spoke up or what he wanted to say or that he said that...
I've forgotten now. Remember, I didn't formally interview him. I just spoke to him casually in a meeting when I arranged it.
Okay.
Remember, I told you like this gas station attendant.
Right.
I stayed away from Gormley. I knew about Gormley.
Okay.
I was down there in 1971 and never looked him up. I waited till the last minute for Gormley.
Yeah.
I didn't want any pressure on him.
Sure.
I figured there's a very good chance of surveillance. Why should I finger?
Right.
When I had an ideal time to talk to Gormley, was when I was exercising discovery and had to go to his office. That didn't finger him.
Right. Okay.
That's the only time I talked to him. I talked to him twice then for a total of just minutes.
Mm-hmm.
One time, not even 2 minutes.
Right.
Jim was with me. I wanted Jim to get the feel of it and get the feel of the man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he told me about Gormley. Jim.
Well, that's how it was.
Right.
I knew about Gormley before I went to Knipe.
Gormley comes out, and he's the one Okay, now let's talk about the package. We got Zachary
committing perjury.
That he found it. He couldn't have been there, and he can't show up on the scene of the crime. I mean, that part
at
of the
at least minute, 15 minutes,
20 minutes, unless
sure.
he's complete.
I go through all of this in the book, don't I?
Right, exactly. And he says he comes over. And, oh, look what I found.
Yeah.
It's like waiting for the president of the United States to arrive and discover the first hot dog stand.
Yeah, I got contemporaneous pictures, Esther.
Okay.
And I know of others that I have seen that I don't have, and I know of others that I haven't seen. I know who haven't. And this is one of the causes of dispute between Bud and me, because Bud stuck me for the expenses of this. I'm a poor man, he's a rich man, and we had an agreement he paid the expenses.
Mm-hmm.
He refused to pay the expenses of my going to get these pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him, fuck you. You can't use them without paying me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had to let him use one, and he's refused to pay for it. We had a fight over it.
He must have an ongoing hassle with him.
It's been continuous. My biggest single problem has been keeping Bud out of trouble. I've kept Ray from firing him 3 times. I've got him to rehire Bud once after he fired him. That's it. You know, that's why I tell you a lot of the stuff that'll be complicated.
Sure, okay.
This is the real inside of it.
Jim
has carried that enormous load for any lawyer, and for a young lawyer, an unbelievable load.
Mm-hmm.
You can't speak highly enough about how he's held up on it.
Yeah.
He doesn't even show the pressures. But because Jim has drawn closer to me, Bud has become more and more alienated from Jim.
Mm-hmm.
But we're both ethical about it.
Right. Well, who has Ray? Ray has retained. No. Ray has retained Fensterwall, Lazar.
I arranged that.
Okay. How did you get involved as an investigator? Now, that, when you talk about the only reason I have Ray, I assume that is an official.
Oh, absolutely. I'm recognized by the state of Tennessee and the federal government.
As Ray?
As Ray's investigator. I've conducted interviews inside of Leavenworth.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau of Prisons recognizes me as Ray's investigator. I carried credentials when I went out to Leavenworth. I interviewed witnesses as part of my investigation for the habeas corpus proceeding in Leavenworth.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed 3 witnesses in Stony and Brushy Mountain. The records all show me.
Yeah, I mean, I never knew that there was a job that
it's
one has.
It's a formal role. Yeah. I am under the protective order of the court, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I can't talk to you about what we got on discovery except what we used.
I see.
Because otherwise I'd be
fishing.
Violating.
Sure, you go fishing and you find out.
Unofficially, I can do other things. I can't talk to you officially about any of this. I'm under wraps.
Okay.
Now, I interviewed 2 prisoners in Brushy Mountain, and I got it on tape. It's one hell of a story about what that so-called James R. Ray cell was used for after Ray was no longer there. It was used as a punishment cell.
Mm-hmm.
I've got descriptions from witnesses of how it was bugged and what happened to them when they engaged in conversations when nobody left.
Yeah. Okay. Where were we just before that one? Stop the tape for a second,
would you? Yeah, you had asked me about things. Now, this is a story of how Ray has a present defense. After the, what I call the mini trial, was over, it was apparent to me that Ray had been framed and put away,
mm-hmm.
and that his own lawyer had been part of it. And this was before I obtained the contracts. And we had a live defendant, a chance to make the system of justice work. What was missing was a lawyer who had no conflict of interest. Haynes's was irreconcilable. I actually got Haynes to admit to me on a talk show on Channel 5 in New York, the one from which Foreman fled, that he couldn't get another penny from Huey until he got Ray back to the United States.
Right.
Haynes was not supposed to represent Ray in England.
Mm-hmm.
But he still did that. This kind of conflict is irreconcilable. And in any decent concept of justice on that basis alone, Ray should be a free man. He was never subject to extradition.
Mm-hmm.
The extradition was a wrongful extradition. Of the people I knew, the one I felt had sufficient independent means and sufficient interest in the subject,
mm-hmm.
not to be saddled by a conflict of interest with Bud. Now, I started writing Frame Up much earlier. Frame Up is abstracted from a longer work called Coup d'Etat,
mm-hmm.
the only work in which I've ever done any theorizing, and it is of an entirely different nature. And it handled the three major assassinations together. There is in that a considerable amount of material that may yet become important. So, I had a friendly relationship with Bud then, although he always held against me the fact that I would not join his committee.
Mm-hmm.
I told him it should not be organized. I told him that what he had as an objective was absolutely unattainable,
mm-hmm.
and that none of the people recognized in the field would have anything to do with it. And when he found out that I was right, he resented it. But we got along well. And I didn't know then what I know now about how nutty Bud can be on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
If I weren't convinced that Bud is nutty on the subject, I'd have to be convinced that he was a federal agent, because nothing else could explain it. I sometimes have difficulty, but I believe that Bud is one of these people who just become irrational on the subject. And it is absolutely astounding how many they are,
mm-hmm.
and the high intelligence they have.
Mm-hmm.
Bud is one of the most affable, pleasant gentlemen you'd ever want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
He does incredible things on the subject, even on a personal level. But I didn't know this then.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about right after the mini trial. Bud's office was down on 15th and K. So one day when I was there, I said, Bud, if I could get ready to ask you to be his lawyer, would you agree to certain simple stipulations? And his response was, if you could get me on the next rocket to the moon, I'd say sure, it'd be quite an adventure. And I said, I can't get you on the next rocket to the moon, but I think it is not impossible for Ray to ask you to be his lawyer. And I am asking you in all seriousness,
mm-hmm.
if this does happen, if you would agree to certain mm-hmm. simple stipulations. He said, you're serious? And I said, yes. He said, it's impossible. I said, then you lose nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm willing to try, but I have to have these preconditions met. These are in writing yesterday, but as best I remember them. One was that I would be the investigator on
mm-hmm.
the case. Another was that there would be no commercialization. Another was that the literary rights would be vested in me, and remind me to come back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, I did not ever use these literary rights.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do it right now. I'll tell you right now. I wanted to keep anybody else from using them.
Right.
You understand?
Sure,
I have no claims for any writing on the Ray case. I wanted to keep anybody else from using the literary rights as a means of exploitation. That's why I wanted them, simply to control them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've refused offers to write on it,
mm-hmm.
as recently as within the past week, when I was in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Argosy wanted me to write on it. Did I tell you that I would be with him every time he saw Ray? Well, in any event.
Okay, basic stipulations.
These are the basic
yeah,
stipulations.
Sure.
Now, my purpose was to keep it clean.
Okay.
My purpose in wanting to be there when Bud was there, my purposes were two. First, I knew that Bud lacked experience in this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and had a certain amount of naivete.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, if I was going to conduct a really good investigation, I had to know everything.
Right.
I also wanted to be able to get readings on Ray.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that every interest was served, including protecting Bud and Ray,
yeah.
by my being there. Bud agreed to these conditions, and to this day had never met them.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you more on this
sure,
if you want, but
yeah.
I don't think it's necessary.
No, I'm sorry.
Now, I did it through Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a year. Bud even stuck me for the cost of the telephone call.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you one quick question about
yes.
Jerry? What are the relations between Jerry and Jimmy now?
Good.
Okay, because there was a problem of real estrangement at the Stoner time.
Do you mean at the time that Ray cut him off from the visitors list?
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But
I'm satisfied that J.B. Stoner was behind that.
Okay.
But I can't prove it.
Right, okay.
So I established a relationship with Jerry in the way I had figured that I could, and it was very simple. And over a period of time, Jerry learned to trust me.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry thinks it was his idea for Fence the Wall to become
mm-hmm.
Junie's lawyer.
Yeah.
It was mine.
Okay.
But the request did come from Jerry,
mm-hmm.
and did come from James. It was all proper.
Right. Okay.
I merely arranged the situation in which it would be a natural development.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, oh, another condition was that Bud would arrange for an experienced and, if possible, well-known criminal lawyer to do the courtroom work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bud never did anything about that, and I can assure you some of my efforts with his permission to interest people in it.
Mm-hmm.
One is Ramsey Clark.
There's another question I want to ask you about Ramsey Clark.
Yeah, but I never got an answer from Ramsey Clark. I can show you the letters.
Yeah.
And this is necessary because Bud's not a criminal lawyer. He's not really a courtroom lawyer.
Right. Well, it's good corporate paper. Well,
that's his work.
Yeah.
And, of course, the political stuff that he did on
sure.
the Hill. None of this is a reflection on Bud
sure,
as a lawyer.
No, yeah,
it's just
a different kind of
not
lawyer.
That kind of
different
lawyer.
Kind of lawyer, yeah.
So you see these perfectly normal stipulations,
sure.
Esther, and nothing self-serving in them.
Right.
There was no penny in it for me,
mm-hmm.
no chance of any penny in it for me. My only interest in the literary rights was to keep them from being misused again,
mm-hmm.
to keep the case from being corrupted again. I have never used them to this day.
Mm-hmm. Frame-up was done all before this anyway.
Pardon
me? Your work on frame-up, but I was just talking about the only thing you did for
yes,
this.
Yes, my work was essentially done.
Right. Okay.
So the agreement was that I would be the investigator from the beginning. The actuality is that I never had any contact with Ray until after my book was printed.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Ray, and I never exchanged any letters with him. I did attempt to write him as soon as the mini-trial was over through Phil Canale. Canale never returned the letter to me,
mm-hmm.
and never gave it to Ray. That was merely to offer to help him in his defense and to tell him that I thought I could. The first time I saw James Ellery was the Monday after the second hearing before Judge Williams in Memphis. It was the Monday after the Saturday on which I took Bob Livingston to the two motels. And I flew up with Bob Livingston.
Mm-hmm.
We flew to Knoxville and then took a car
mm-hmm.
and drove to Brushy Mountain. At that point, I met the warden and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And interviewed Ray for the first time in Bob Livingston's presence.
Mm-hmm. And Jerry had been the intermediary to make you the official investigator.
Jerry came to realize that the conditions that I had stipulated to Bud were essential.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry has his own kind of reasoning on this, and there's a certain amount of soundness to it. He's explained it to me several times. Even though Jerry is far right and a racist,
mm-hmm.
Jerry believes that the only thing wrong with niggers is Jews.
Mm-hmm.
it's the National States Rights Party belief.
Right.
We've slept
and
together.
And he's dealing with you and Fensterwolf.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's got to
But he knows I am.
Right.
Jerry
yeah.
knows I am. And he knows that the Thunderbolt has written these vicious things about me.
Right.
Nonetheless, he trusted me. And it took a period of time for him to develop this trust
mm-hmm.
and to see that I had no ulterior motive in it. And as he once explained to me, if he were going to be represented in a criminal case,
mm-hmm.
he would want a man like a Kunstler or a Stoner, because he felt that these men would be incorruptible and would act out of principle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would sooner defend myself than have Stoner defend me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Ray, that's Jerry's thinking.
Yeah.
So you see, this was consistent with all of that. The only time I ever interviewed Jimmy in the presence of